Our first speaker today is Ambassador Robert Seipel, and we're honored to have his presence here to lead off the conference. Ambassador Robert Seipel has spent the last number of decades focusing on humanitarian solutions across the world, involved with a number of major international organizations, global organizations such as World Vision, founded the Institute for Global Engagement, an institute that is one of the core sponsors of this event, and struggles for the development of sustainable environments for religious freedom worldwide, as well as attempting to equip emerging leaders with faith-based methodologies of engagement. Robert Seipel spent a number of years in the State Department as the first ever U.S. ambassador at large for international religious freedom. This position, created by the International Religious Freedom Act of 1988, was charged with promoting religious freedom worldwide, promoting reconciliation in those areas where conflict had been implemented along religious lines, and making sure that the issue, the fundamental right of religious freedom, was woven into the fabric of U.S. foreign policy. He's been an articulate spokesman for this issue, and also an articulate critic of his own U.S. public policy as well in this area. He is a recipient of a number of awards and honors. I won't go through the extensive list. They are including eight doctors, recipient of eight doctors, as well as the Secretary of State's Distinguished Public Service Award, and the list goes on. You can read it for yourselves on the conference website on the bio section. Ambassador Seipel, I'm delighted to have you here today.
Thank you very much. I'm sitting back there looking at this beautiful chapel, and a flashback to the opening chapters of Moby Dick, where the man who was going to bless the fleet and Ahab going out climbed up into that vaulted position and gave his blessing to that crew, that unsuspecting crew, about to go out on the treacherous shoals of Massachusetts. Has absolutely nothing to do with the treacherous shoals of religious freedom, but I am honored to be here today. I have to tell you, I'm a little bit surprised. I'm a little bit surprised because, first and foremost, I'm not a lawyer. Now, I like what lawyers have done. Lawyers have come to this issue sooner, faster, better than anybody else, a whole lot faster than the NGO community. And they've laid the tracks. And we've got good international law. We've got good domestic law as it relates to religious freedom. So I'm delighted that we have lawyers. I'm just not one of them. I'm also not a theologian. But I get to talk to theologians. I was with a group once not too long ago, and they were having a very spirited discussion about something extremely important. Theologians don't speak about anything that's not very important, you know. So they were speaking, and at the end of their talking together, they asked me what I thought. And I couldn't help myself. The words just flew out of my mouth. I'm glad I met Jesus before I met a theologian. Well, you would have thought I had just burnt the Dead Sea Scrolls. I spent the next 6 months apologizing, not because of how I felt, but what I said about how I felt. Thirdly, I'm not a scholar. I have tremendous respect for those who have put the intellectual discussions together and have worked diligently and persistently down through decades in many respects. But again, that's not me. I'm an activist. Now, the difference between a scholar and an activist is footnotes. I don't do footnotes. I want all of my experiences to be experiences. I want to speak from the standpoint of experience. So everything that I tell you today, I've had something to do with. And if we get to a place where I need to add a footnote, of course I will do that. I want to begin by telling you a story about a young woman in Lebanon during the large conflict that went on from the 80s into the 90s, which was really a religious war. Her name was Mary. Her name is Mary. And she was 18 years old during that conflict. And there came a day in that conflict when the rival militia came into our village and began to shoot up the town. Everybody began to run. Chaos, anarchy. Mary ran, but she tripped, fell down to the ground. Before she could get up, a young militiaman came to her, put a pistol to her head, and knowing that she was a Christian, said, "Renounce the cross or die." 18 years old. Some of you are close to 18 years old. What would you have done? Mary looked up at her young assailant. She said, "I'm a Christian. I was born a Christian. I will die a Christian." The pistol went off in her face. The bullet went in just to the left of her chin and came out the base of her skull, but not before it went totally, completely through her spinal cord. And instantly, Mary is a quadriplegic. The assailant then reached over with his knife and carved a cross on her chest. Now, the next day, the militia had a problem. They had chosen to stay in that town. And if you're going to stay in that town, you have to bury the people you've killed the day before. It's hot in Lebanon. Bodies begin to decompose. They came to this wild heap of mangled humanity. All of Mary's relatives were killed that day. And when they came to that heap of humanity, they heard a very small groan. Miraculously, Mary was still alive. Just as miraculously, the militia took her and transported her to a nearby hospital. Now, I'm sitting there listening to Mary, this young lady who is now chained basically to a wheelchair, held hostage by her own body, an Arab woman destined to live out her life in an institution. And I said, "Mary, this makes no sense at all. Why did the people who wanted to kill you one day take you down to a hospital the next day so that you could live?" She smiled at me, very confident smile. And she says, "You know, sometimes God uses bad people to do good things." And I said, "Mary, well, how do you feel about your assailant?" She said, "I forgive him. I've already forgiven him. I hope he's still alive because I want to forgive him face to face." "Mary, why in the world would you want to forgive this guy?" "What my God did for me. I can do no less." Mary taught me all I know about religious freedom. And I want you to think of the outcome of Mary's story as we explore minority religion's role in the geopolitical calculus. Mary has been reduced to wheelchair status. Her only freedom is religious freedom. For Mary, that is enough. Mary experienced the ultimate and coercive behavior. This is what human rights are all about. When someone coerces you to do something that's not right, that's not your will. Freedom of choice diminished. And the ultimate and coercive behavior was used to diminish that freedom in Mary. Mary knew that for faith to be authentic, it has to be freely embraced. That's a key principle of human rights, especially religious freedom. For faith to be authentic, it must be freely embraced. She also knew and could echo Martin Luther King, "If one is not free, nobody is free." These are the principles that drove her to extend the hand of reconciliation. Most importantly for me, Mary brought to the forefront this critical issue of identity. And when your identity is primarily formed by your religion, and 84% of the peoples of the world, I got this from Pew, 84% of the people of the world believe in a power higher than themselves. So when your identity involves religion, it is extremely passionate. And when that identity is put upon, coerced, pressed down, destroyed, abused, the world is a little more vulnerable. You know, Indonesia, as an example, had a long, long history of religious tolerance. They had the five great religions there, and nobody ever had a problem getting along with everybody else until the religious conflicts began about a decade ago. And as soon as they began, every Muslim knew where every Christian lived, every Christian knew where every Muslim lived, because when it broke out into fierce fighting, people wanted to know in what direction to run. It was all part of their identity. Maybe a better example is Bosnia. Terrible conflict in Bosnia, which was both ethnic and religious. You had Orthodox Serbs, Catholic Croats, Bosniaks, Muslims, fighting 3 or 4 years. I used to go into Sarajevo, though, in the beginning of the 1990s, and I never saw a woman wearing a burqa on the streets. 3 years later, which is to say 3 years of ethnic and religious cleansing later, you saw burqas all over the place. Why? Because identity became paramount and people wanted to make their identity statement. There was a picture, it's either on Newsweek or on Time magazine back then, of a white man behind concertina wire in prison. He could have been 50 or 60 years old. Shirt was off. You could see every bone in his body. You looked at the picture and you had echoes of what happened in your 50 years earlier. You didn't know if he was a Muslim, a Christian, a Catholic, or an Orthodox, a Jew. You didn't know. It could have been anybody. What it was somebody who was other than this person. The other in our midst. Turned out it happened to be a Muslim. Slavenka Drakulic, writing in the Balkan Express, had this chilling thing to say about that situation in Bosnia. She said, "Someone is always a Jew. Someone is always a Jew. And once the concept of otherness takes root, the unimaginable becomes possible. It's all tied to identity. Religious wars are the ultimate identity conflicts, representing the worst of coercive behavior. Mary found this out. Renounce the cross or die. The world is no longer safe for diversity. And when conflict breaks out, religious wars tend to be longer, more brutal, and less predictable than any other kind of war." Now, there's some good news in this story of Mary, because in that story you see the best of faith working itself out against the worst of religion. The specific outcome, Mary initiated the principles of reconciliation. She extended the hand of love. More generally, no government or people have anything to fear when religion is practiced at its best. But the final takeaway, maybe the most critical one. Today in our world, people kill for their religion. There is some graffiti on a partially standing wall, 9/11, Twin Trade Towers in New York City. It said simply this: "God, protect me from those who believe in you." People kill for their religion. And there are people like Mary, just as many people like Mary, who are willing to die for their faith. We neglect this component, this religious component, this major component of our personal identity in our geopolitical thinking, in our foreign policy, at our considerable peril. Now, in partial response to these takeaways, the U.S. created the International Religious Freedom Act in 1998. Canada, gratefully, has now done the same. We did ours after 18 months of very fierce but good debate. You know, there are two things you don't talk about when you're growing up. You're always told there's two things you can't talk about. Can't talk about politics, can't talk about religion. And here faith was coming, our church was coming to state. 85 to 95% of the problems in the world take place at the nexus of religion and politics. One of the biggest hurdles to overcome in all of this is to have people talk about it. Thank goodness for conferences like this. Well, I want to go through very quickly that legislation. It's good legislation. It's been around now for about 13 years. In a series of couplets, two thoughts regarding timing. First thought, this was Monica Lewinsky's time. I don't know how much you know about Monica Lewinsky, but let me tell you, in Washington, D.C., nothing else happened but this conversation. Monica Lewinsky, nothing got through Congress, nothing got through the Senate, except for this act. This act was approved unanimously by every congressman, every senator, before it was enacted. I think that's kind of nice. The second thing about timing is that this was pre-9/11, pre-Arab Spring, pre-religious conflicts popping up all around the world. It was a prescient act. It was a prophetic act in terms of its timing. Let me give you two unintended consequences of the act. We should have known this, but we're not all that smart, and we didn't. But the first unintended consequence, when this bill was enacted in Washington, we made hope tangible for millions of faceless, nameless people around the world. Pardon the language, but it was useful then, the last remaining superpower. In the halls of justice, in the corridors of power, we're standing up for people who could not stand up for themselves. We're speaking out for people who this day were being abused, were being coerced because of how they believed and in whom they believed. And now it was no longer hope deferred, but their hope was credible, their hope was legitimate, their hope was possible. Second unintended consequence, we had and still have a required report that we report every year on religious freedom in all the countries of the world. There are 196 countries that we've reported on them. You know, you don't do that alone. You can't do that alone. By the time this first report was done, we had enlisted the aid of about 600 Foreign Service officers in embassies around the world who now had as part of their portfolio religious freedom, to look at it in that country, to monitor it, to report back. Do you know what happens when 600 people get involved with a project? Automatically, you begin to institutionalize that act. It was the hardest thing to tell people in the State Department that there's one more issue on your bilateral agenda. You got to start talking about religious freedom. Oh, we don't want to do that. Especially in the Middle East, we don't want to do that. But if you get 600 people who are contributing to something, you weave that idea, you weave that issue into the bureaucracy of the United States, into the State Department, the largest sausage factory in Washington, D.C. I can tell you from experience. Now, one caveat about the report. The report reported on 196 countries. We were not one of them. We did not report on ourselves. And that hubris did not go unnoticed. And it made the implementation of the act a little bit more difficult. I remember my first time with my Chinese interlocutor, Ye Hafei. We ended up calling him a Ye of little faith. But Ye Hafei, sitting across the table, first thing out of his mouth said, who made you the international morality cop? So there's some hubris attached to that, and I'd be happy to answer how I answered that later on. We also had another couplet here, two emphases in terms of the implementation of it. There was one group that very much wanted to use this as a punishment hammer. Name, blame, shame. sanctions to follow. And the United States sanctions more countries than any five countries put together. But they wanted to rise up on their tiptoes, beat their chest, win the testosterone wars, and throw the book at the bad guys. That works in Washington, D.C. It doesn't work in any other place in the world. You put up the fist, and you get the fist in return. The other emphasis was simply to promote religious freedom, to find the point of vested self-interest and work together for a win-win scenario. Personally, I don't believe you can punish nations into good behavior. And you'll not be surprised that I favored the second approach. Well, it was surprising, another couplet here. There were two competing claims for attention. One was our national interest. And you know what national interest is all about? It's hard power. Our national interest, keep the trade routes open, make sure this economic engine continues to pump, and make sure we're safe. Security and trade. Alongside of that was national values. Soft power. Soft power representing human dignity, human rights, our better angels. And I used to wonder when I sat in these meetings at the State Department why national values were not part and parcel of our national interests. And I used to say to these folks, you know, you can get good people in the room and negotiate the hard issues, but in the soft issues, people like Mary are willing to die for them. Now, unless you think this is approaching naivete on my part, let me give you one quick example. George W. Bush, in his second inaugural address, early in that address, made this statement, America's vital interest and our deepest beliefs are now one. Our interest and our values are now one. Now, you can write that off as simply inaugural rhetoric, flourishing, over the top, all the rest, but in May of that year, there was a specific incident that took place in Uzbekistan. There was a labor strike. And the labor force, they weren't getting paid well. They didn't like what was happening to them. They went on strike. They created a little bit of chaos in the town of Andijan, Uzbekistan. The president, Islam Karimov, who was a thug when I met him 15 years ago, is still a thug today, still a president today. Karimov didn't like this. And so he sends in his troops, and his troops begin shooting up the place. And by the time they're done, somewhere between 500 and 1,500 workers are now dead. The Bush administration called for an international investigation. Karimov said, it's an internal affair, you stay out of it. No, we're not going to stay out of it. It's part of our national values. We're going to insert ourselves in it. We want an international investigation. And Karimov finally said to the Bush administration, if you keep pushing this, I'm going to kick you out of that base that we're letting you use, that military base from which we prosecuted the war in Afghanistan. And the administration from the U.S. came back and said, we'll get out of the base. We'll give up. Realpolitik. We'll give up hard power because this is important to us. And our vital interest and our deepest beliefs are now one. There are not many examples of that. This is hard stuff, balancing national interest in national values. Anyway, governments certainly can play a role. But for my money, individuals are still the key. You know, individuals come up to me all the time and say, I'm not in government. I'm not a military person. What can I do? I got an answer for them. This is what you do. Understand your own faith at its deepest and richest best. Understand why you believe. And if you have chosen not to believe, understand deeply why you hold that position. Go deeper with your faith. What are the eternal verities of the faith? What's the orthodoxy of the faith? Who are the heroes of your faith? Who are the martyrs of the faith? Who are those, in the words of Pascal, who say the good men believe this to be true? The world's not kind to superficiality. And as an aside, I think that superficiality in our thinking is one of the great threats to our way of life, even to our democracy. Go deep. Understand your own faith at its deepest and richest best. And if you don't, you will lose your seat at the table. You will be irrelevant. Or to use that term from Miroslav Volf, for those of you who've come here from Yale, you will become comfortably inconsequential. What a great phrase. Who among us wants to be comfortably inconsequential? Know about enough about your faith. Go deep with your faith, but then the second part is this, and it's just as important. Know enough about your neighbor's faith in order to show it respect. Notice I didn't use the word toleration. Respect. The word toleration is in all the international covenants. I don't like the word. I wish we'd stop using it. Toleration is forbearance. It's not equality. Toleration takes us to a lower common denominator. I don't really like you, but I will tolerate you. Oh, big deal. Toleration is a cheap form of grace applied to people I don't especially care for. No, go to respect. Respect lifts up our common humanity. Respect celebrates that humanity. Respect says, yes, there's a divine spark. Yes, there's the image of God. Yes, something greater than ourselves is worthwhile. That's driving this whole enterprise of religious freedom. And for humanity, our free will. No lowest common denominator here. Know how to listen. Even as you discuss faith in a language and a logic that the other understands. You remember the Danish cartoons, that big flap back in 2005. You had an editor who didn't know, you had a cartoonist who didn't care. And this lack of understanding coupled with this absence of respect, and by the way, you can't respect something you don't know, you ended up with two individuals driving unnecessary wedges into the heart of religious understanding. It did not have to be that way. Function of knowledge. It's a function of responsibility. It's the accountability that comes from knowledge and being responsible for what you do with it. And in this case, understanding your own faith and respecting your neighbors. You know, if all of us would do that in the world today, we would not have one sectarian bullet flying out there. There'd be no more sectarian conflicts. They would be over, and the world would be a safer place. Individuals are important to that safer place, and we can do better. And each one is responsible for the role we have to play. Let me give you an example of where this all came together. The NGOs and the government and the private citizens. I've been going to Laos since 1989. Every time I go, it seems to be wearing a different hat, but they've all been on a humanitarian mission. And at the same time, building up credibility until we got to this issue of religious freedom. We spent a lot of time with the Lao in Washington, D.C. We spent a lot of time at the embassy. I've gotten to know the ambassadors well. We go out to dinner with our spouses. We play golf together. They're very good golfers. I don't know how they got to be good golfers. There's only four golf courses in all of Laos, but every Foreign Service officer that comes out of Laos is a good golfer. Well, I wouldn't say good, but better than me, which is not the greatest compliment I can pay anybody. We had them out, and we used to have them out once a year to our place. We lived in Maryland Eastern Shore on the water, and we'd have the whole embassy out. Ambassador, his staff, and their kids, about 50 people. They'd bring sticky rice and dessert. We'd bring Maryland crabs, and we'd sit down under a tent and go fishing, go out in the boat, and go up the rivers. And by the way, if you go up one river there where we lived, you come to the summer Dhaka of the Russian embassy. And I would always point that out to him and then go back and point out our house with the Lao flag flying in front of our house on Lao Day. This is your summer, Dhaka. They love that. I think the breakthrough in our relationship with Laos, and it's been a good relationship, we brought over the highest level Lao delegation ever to come to the United States. Six people, headed by the vice president for the Lao National Front. They came and they stayed for 15 days. They were the most exhausting 15 days I've ever spent in my life. We did everything together. We got them into the Congress. We got them to talk to Senator Lugar when he was still a senator. God bless us all. We went up to Capitol Hill and we went up to the White House. We went up to the memorials. I still remember the head of the delegation going into the Lincoln Memorial and reading the things that Lincoln said on the side of the wall and beginning to cry. You don't normally see communists cry. We took them to churches. We took them to synagogues. We took them to the Lao Buddhist campsite that exists outside of Washington. We took them to Ground Zero. We took them to the Lion King. We took them over to the UN. We took them to a baseball game. That night, Baltimore beat the Yankees. It was a blessed time. We introduced them to people who had come from Laos. Various citizens, sometimes three generations removed, two generations, first generation, they all have a different perspective on what America is all about and what Laos is all about. We essentially showed them a pluralistic environment. We didn't try to sell them. We didn't try to coerce them. We just wanted to spend 15 days showing them what it can be, what it can do, how it can be helpful. Maybe the most important day, we went up to central Pennsylvania and we spent the day with an Amish farmer. He was so happy that we were there, showed us everything, his farm, his buildings, how they work, how they're different, the farm animals, and so on. Liked us, so he invited us into his home. We get into his home and he says, "This is my home. This is where we worship on Sundays." And you can almost hear the Lao mind begin to click into place. Ah, house church. And then the farmer says, "Yeah, we worship down in the basement." Ah, underground house church. But they saw someone who was in a minority status, someone who was different, someone who wanted to be different, someone who wanted to educate their kids differently, train their kids differently, dress differently, talk differently, and yet stay in America. And all the laws that were local and the state and the federal laws were there to protect this difference, to allow them to be who they wanted to be, and they in return gave us the richness of their culture, the richness woven into the total tapestry that becomes America. They saw the minority faith. They saw the other. They saw them protected. Not subtracting from, but adding to the stability of a nation. Values and interests coming together. They went home after 15 days. And in the next 2 weeks, they went around Laos on their own dime. At the time, there were 37 Christians that were incarcerated because of religious freedom issues. They opened the door to 34 of them. They released 34 of 37 in the 2 weeks that they got back. This was an educated exercise that increased the stability of Laos, and also created a positive impression towards every other nation. They saw what they were doing. Laos now has most favored nation status. They didn't have it then. They are now part of the WTO. They didn't have it then. They had an international black eye in terms of the human rights. That has been removed. And the security and religious freedom have emerged for the Lao as two sides of the same coin. You know, if the population thinks its government has its best interest in mind, they will be loyal. And when you have a loyal population, you have a stable population. And when you have a stable population, you have a secure government. And there's more of that in Laos today. How does all this happen? Individuals like Mary, countries like Laos, soft power, hard power, some would call it smart power, coming together. National interest and national values certainly becoming one. Majority faith and minority faith working in tandem to solve mutually interdependent problems. Folks, it takes a full-orbed, clear-eyed, deep-thinking, highly reflective people to get that done. You can't be superficial about this issue. You can't be superficial about your faith, or if you have no faith, you cannot be superficial in the chaos of today's world. There's anarchy out there. And the seat at the table is waiting for someone to come with an answer. And you may have the answer, but you have to be clear-eyed. You have to know how things work. You have to be smart. You have to be commonsensical. Let me close with this. When Jesus sent out the disciples to engage the world, this is found, by the way, in Matthew 10:16. I footnote that. You're welcome. When he sent them out, he said, I have two methodologies for you to follow, and they have to be done concurrently. Number one, I want you to be as innocent as a dove. Innocent as a dove. Extend the hand. Love the person. Show mercy. Be tenderhearted. Be compassionate. Be innocent. Be dove-like. And the second methodology, and I want you to be shrewd as a snake. I want you to be practical. I want you to be pragmatic. I want you to be commonsensical. I want you to know how the world works before you go out there and try to embrace it with a loving embrace. Don't get it wrong. There's too much out there that's already wrong. You know, John Wayne, that great Western movie theologian that we had so many years in the U.S., always had this to say. He said, you know, it's a difficult world out there. It's really difficult if you're stupid. Thank you, John. We can't be stupid. Too much is at stake. Innocent as a dove, shrewd as a snake. Pragmatic compassion, streetwise affection, realistic compulsion, knowledgeable and accountable respect. Think on these things.
One of our faculty members will be offering a short response, and we'll open up for discussion and exchange. Professor Arvind Sharma is one of our renowned faculty members at Religious Studies. He was born in India, in Varanasi, studied at Allahabad University, and initially in economics, but then pursued his lifelong passion for comparative religion and completed a PhD in Sanskrit and Indian Studies at Harvard University in 1978. Was the first Infinity Foundation visiting professor of Indic studies at Harvard University, and then succeeded one of the legendary figures at both McGill University and Harvard University, Wilfred Campbell Smith, succeeded him to the Burke's Chair of Comparative Religion at McGill University. Professor Sharma is one of the most prolific scholars at McGill University, with over 50 books, over 500 articles in fields of comparative religion, Hinduism, Indian philosophy and ethics, human rights and religion, religious freedom, and the role of women in religion. He has a passionate interest in issues around religious freedom and the role of religion within foreign policy. And Professor Sharma, I ask you to step up here and say a few words.
Thank you, Ambassador, for an inspiring talk. I would like to start by extending your conclusion a bit with an illustration from the life of Mahatma Gandhi, reinforcing the idea that one has to be innocent as doves, but wise as serpents. It was the time of the partition of the country when passions were running high in the country, especially in Bengal. Mahatma Gandhi found himself in one of the villages with a small band of followers, one of whom was a Muslim woman. And she went into a village where there had been what we call communal disturbances in India, meaning conflict between Hindus and Muslims. And it was a Muslim-majority village, and she went in and complained to her co-religionists that you have removed two swords, decorative swords, from a Hindu temple and dedicated to the goddess. And as a gesture of goodwill, you should restore those swords to your Hindu brethren. The people were in no mood to do that, and they resisted the idea and even became bellicose in the resistance. So that got her righteous indignation up, kind of a level of righteous indignation to a point when she said that if you don't do it right now, I'm going to stop eating. They said, you can do whatever you want. So she said, if you don't do it right now, I will stop drinking water. And they said, you can do whatever you want. So she lay down on a cot in front of the masjid. And soon word was sent to Gandhi that this has happened, that this Amtul Islam is lying on a bed, on a cot, refusing to take either food or water in order to persuade her co-religionists to restore the soul. Gandhi sent her a message. The message said, drink water. Give God time to work his miracle. This is the combination of idealism and realism, which I think the ambassador was referring to, a concrete illustration. I'll now turn to the talk and like to offer three comments, two in support of what has been said, and one which would problematize some of the things we have been talking about. It seems to me the example of inspiring example of Mary reminded me of an incident associated with the Dalai Lama. I think all this has to do with the idea that along with religious freedom, if you are really a true believer in it, you also achieve what we might call spiritual freedom of a certain kind. And the story goes that a Lama was released by the Chinese, who had long been in detention, and was finally allowed to move to India. So the Dalai Lama was having a discussion with him, and he recounted the tortures to which he had been subject. So the Dalai Lama asked him, did you ever feel that your life was in danger. And he said, yes, it did happen once or twice. And the Dalai Lama asked him, when was that? And he said, on one or two occasions, I almost began to hate the Chinese. This is, puts it in the class of Mary. This is when he felt that his life was really threatened, when he felt that he was beginning to hate the Chinese. My second comment has to do with the use of the word tolerance, and I of course take your point that the word could have connotations of putting up with something rather than warmly accepting it. But I would like to suggest that the word seems to have lost that particular, well, not entirely lost, but has moved beyond in its semantic range to accept the idea of respect within its semantic ambit. So nowadays when we use the word religious tolerance, maybe I'm trying to justify myself because I'm busy writing a book on a history of religious tolerance or religions. But while researching the word tolerance in that context, I discovered that the idea of acceptance has now become a part of the meaning of the word. But we still have to guard against that danger, which you mentioned. And on that point, I would also like to refer to an incident in the life of Maimonides, who has been, I think, regarded as, some regard him as the greatest Jew after Moses. And Maimonides apparently had to, when he had to flee Spain, had to feign conversion to Islam to save his life. And finally, of course, he got out, and then he became the personal physician of the ruler of Egypt. At that point, somebody actually moved a Sharia court that Maimonides had become an apostate because he was now claiming to be a Jew after having converted to Islam. And the Grand Mufti of Al-Azhar gave his judgment that conversion under pressure cannot be accepted as genuine conversion to Islam. It reminds us of the famous line in the Quran, there is no compulsion in religion, like Rahafiddin. So that even the legal tradition has upheld the sanctity of religious freedom. The point I would like to problematize is the paradox to which the ambassador referred, that one of the unintended consequences of the emphasis on religious freedom was to emphasize one's religious identity, which in a sense can be seen as contributing to religious conflict. When religious identities get intensified, then this could be one of the consequences. And this then reminds me of the title of a book by Winifred Sullivan. It's a very intriguing title. It runs as follows: The Impossibility of Religious Freedom. And our main argument is that religious freedom is best secured by not emphasizing religious freedom, but treating it as a subcategory under freedom in general, say under freedom of expression and so on. That's all that I have to say. Thank you.
We're going to try to stick to schedule. We do have a bit of a short period of time for some questions, so I'll open up the floor. Imad? There's a microphone here just to in the front here.
Good morning, Ambassador Saipal. Thank you for. My name is Imad. I'm an MA student here at McGill. Thank you for a very moving speech. I'm particularly happy to hear you voice your concern with the harder strand of U.S. Policies. And encouraging everyone here to understand their faith before they engage in issues of freedom of religion. I'd like, however, to go back to the story with which you began your speech, the story of Mary. As someone who lived through the years of the Lebanese Civil War, I have no doubt that such horrific stories have taken place more than that on both sides of the fence. My point, however, is these stories do not come close to capturing the complexities at the center of the Lebanese Civil War. And that, in my view, launches us straight into the topic of this conference and the course that we've been attending. Last week we had Professor Elizabeth Hurd representing one end of this debate. We had Ambassador Tom Farr and Chris Seipel probably representing the other end. We had Professor Philpott, maybe I place him somewhere in the middle. But Professor Hurd particularly was, told us how the great sense of pride which Americans feel about religious freedom, and they feel it's like a national product they have to export and promote. She also warned us against elevating religion in these issues above all other human aspects. The problematic of this approach is that it reduces all the complexities down to religion, which is just might be one element, but it ignores looking at all other elements. And raises the question, why can't we, instead of focusing on religion, totally on religion in foreign diplomacy in addressing these complexities, why can't we use the rule of law, United Nations, human rights resolutions, NGOs, activities, etc., etc.? I think that's essentially the main issue of this debate. Thank you.
Let me recap. To recap, I gather that you felt I was a tad superficial, but you talked to people last week, like my son, who are a lot deeper than me. That's the problem with so much time to say so many things, and I try not to complicate. I mean, I intentionally. But there's no question. Religious freedom is one of many factors. I happen to think it's the strongest factor composing one's identity, because we have such a history of people willing to die for it. Yeah, Lebanon has multiple characters, and now a few more. Some of them coming from Syria, some of them going to Syria. Sometimes you get so far along in a situation that you don't remember how things started. You know, once the person straps on a suicide vest and walks into a crowded pizza parlor and blows the place up, the moderate voice is gone. And it's us against them. So things have a way of getting very simplistic when it gets down to the actual fighting. But to your point, going into that, there are many, many factors. And I appreciate your point of view. I'm glad that you understand Lebanon. By the way, they have tremendous cashews. Best cashews in the world. There was another question there. Two, three. Ma'am?
Thank you. I'm Dolores Sandoval, Professor Emerita from the University of Vermont and the founder here of the DaCosta Angelique Institute, which is Quebec's first black think tank, and the MOI project, a museum, Observatoire de l'Immigration. And I'd like to speak to your comments about tolerance, toleration. I have the same visceral response to tolerance as colorblindness. Why would anyone opt to be proud of being colorblind? They wouldn't walk into a garden of plants and flowers and say, oh, I can't see the difference here. Yet they would say that same thing about human skin color and the differentiation that makes us so special and unique. Thank you for both of your comments.
Thank you. We had someone who came from the very back to the very front. You know, he looks like a diplomat, but he's too young. He can't do it.
Andrew Bennett, Ambassador of Religious Freedom here in Canada. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ambassador. Wonderful talk. And I wanted to extend one of the points that you made that I thought was very, very important. I enjoy listening to a wonderful online radio station, Ancient Faith Radio. And there's a podcast on there that really helps me to understand my faith much more deeply. And the name of the podcast is Speaking the Truth in Love. And I think in knowing your point about having to know our faith deeply allows us to encounter the other in love and to speak to that question of human dignity. And the whole focus of our activities in the Office of Religious Freedom here is on human dignity. The focus is not on theological debates, but on human issues, the fundamental dignity that we all have. But I wanted to extend your point about knowing our faith deeply to also knowing what our faith has come to say about the world and about the political sphere deeply as well. And our work, and I know the work of the Office in the United States, ties into broader goals in foreign policy, key principles such as freedom, democracy, rule of law, and broader human rights. And I think too often we have been victims to an idea that we can deconstruct those concepts to the point where they become somehow culturally specific. So freedom, democracy, rule of law, well, they work for Canada, they work for the United States, they work for liberal democracies, but China, Saudi Arabia, they just do things differently. And somehow we can't advance those principles when we talk about advancing religious freedom. And so I was wondering about that whole question of deconstruction of ideas that sometimes leads us to a kind of a nihilistic nothingness where we can't actually advance or speak the truth in love.
Well, let me tell you everything I know about that. That was a joke, a boat. That. The Canadians don't get that joke. Boy, we'd do an awful lot more with love. Truth without love is aggression. Love without truth is mere sentimentality. So they have to be harnessed together to be credible. But boy, we'd have an awful lot better world if we could do that. And those issues have to come together. And they have to be woven into the fabric of all these other points that you made about the things that a government wants to do and wants to see in terms of a comprehensive approach to religious freedom. By the way, when we started this in the States, we had some pushback because they thought that we're creating a hierarchy of values, and religious freedom was the highest. They didn't want to do that. And I didn't think it was a valid argument, because who cares if it's up there or wherever it is? But you look at a country that doesn't have religious freedom going on today, and I'll show you a lot of other values that they don't have. So it's critical. And there's a reason that it's in our First Amendment. There's a reason that we elevate it, if that's the right word to use. So yeah, there are, again, many, many things going on in the world. Hard to be the person that's going to meld them all in a balanced way, in a thoughtful way, for the betterment of someone else. But what's the alternative? An Arab Spring gone away. Conflict that it's going to take decades if it ever gets straightened out. Regional instability. We have seen, because we have practiced this, we have presented this, we have worked with countries. One of the things that we did with the IGE, Institute for Global Engagement, we specifically committed ourselves to working with the toughest countries in the world. We started with China, Laos, Vietnam, Uzbekistan, then Pakistan, and Syria until we were thrown out. And there's some interest in us going to North Korea. They're tough countries. If you can't make it work, and if you can't make your faith work there, why would you want to practice it in this country? That's one of the reasons we chose the tough countries, to see if our methodologies, bottom up, top down, kind of the world vision, State Department, coming together, working with these multiple objectives of a country. And sometimes their motivation, even when they do the right thing, their motivation is so far removed from where we would like it to be. But we'll take it, as long as people are a little bit more free today. And we'll continue to work with countries to the point of spiritual, legal, economic sustainability, so that people have the freedom that comes from all of those things when they are done well in a government that wants to protect them. Congratulations on getting it going in Canada. There may be 1,000 other ambassadors at large that come after you, but by golly, you're the first.
thank you, Ambassador Seipel. Thank you for the questions. I know there's a lot more questions out there. We'll have opportunities both during the break and in other sessions.